your host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockeypedia Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy Jack Ha. And Jack, what's going on, man?
Great to be back. Before we get started, I just want to congratulate everybody with the Tampere hockey team. I had the great fortune of working with the team, and we just won the Liga title. So congrats to all the players, all the staff members, all the fans. Great city, great league to work in. So, you know, they allow me to come on these shows and talk about North American hockey, which works out wonderfully for us. So that's a good thing for the PDO listeners as well.
Well, congratulations to everyone involved, and thank you to them for letting you come on and do these shows, because they're always a blast and the listeners always enjoy it. And the plan for today is we are going to break down each round two matchup the same way we did with our pal Jack Fraser in round one ahead of that. So we're going to use everything we just saw in these round one games to break these series down by looking at teams' respective strengths, weaknesses, things opponents can exploit, factors that will potentially make a difference. And I think just generally, hopefully, stuff for people to look for when they're enjoying these games from their couch. And so hopefully this next hour or so is going to help you get prepared for this next round of playoff hockey. And let's get into it, because we've got a jam-packed show today and we have no time to waste. Let's start with the East. Let's do Panthers Bruins. This is obviously a rematch of last year's round one banger between the two teams, except the difference this time is that the roles are reversed, with Florida coming in as the prohibitive favorite compared to last year. I'll start with this. On a recent show, I was kind of lamenting all of the disappointing missed opportunities in round one by the Leafs when they were playing the Bruins. And in doing so, I also thought about how this particular Panthers team is perfectly equipped to essentially do all of those things effectively to the Bruins based on what we saw in round one. And so I don't know if you feel that same way, but I really just feel like they're just so prepared and equipped to just punish them in all these ways that they are able to kind of get away with in round one.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like the simplest team building recipe is you come back the following year with better players. And it seems to me like the Panthers came back with, you know, the same, if not a better roster, whereas the Bruins obviously losing Bergeron and Krejci. You know, it's a difficult act to follow after last season. And if you remember last season, I was one of the very few people who called for an upset, Panthers over Bruins. And that ended up happening because the Panthers just played a type of relentless, high-tempo game that didn't give the Bruins a lot of time to think. And I don't see why they would change that recipe. And the Bruins are not as well-equipped to handle that as last season.
Yeah, their chaos, it can be very difficult, I think, for Boston's sort of more precision-based and structured-based approach to the way they kind of map these games out. And I think in particular, compared to what you saw in round one, like the Panthers just aren't going to get bogged down in the neutral zone, right? Like they're not going to worry about trying to carry the puck up the ice and trying to sort of penetrate Boston's set defense the way that Toronto did, for example. I think they're going to be much more comfortable just essentially playing puck hunting, puck pursuit hockey, getting the puck deep, and then going in off the forecheck and punishing this Bruins defense. And there's just going to be no easy breakouts, I think, for Boston. And they had so many of them in round one against Toronto. And I think in particular, McAvoy was sort of visibly having a really tough go of it in round one, just handling the puck. It felt like he was making so many mistakes trying to make a play with it. And with him, even Lindholm and Carlo, and then the two young defensemen they have in Lauri and Weatherspoon, and certainly Shattenkirk, I feel like all of these guys are very susceptible to being pressured and making mistakes with the puck. And so it feels like we saw that last year in this matchup, but I feel like even more so this year, Florida should have a lot of success creating easy and quick looks off of these turnovers.
Yeah. So, you know, the Boston back end, once you get past McAvoy and Lindholm, it's a little bit thin, but also, during the series, Jim Montgomery called out David Pastrnak for not being involved enough and not really, obviously aside from the big goals, but you know, he wasn't a noticeable ship-to-ship presence. And like Florida will do that to you. Like, you know, Boston, if they split up Marchand and Pastrnak, they'll very easily get overwhelmed by Florida's sort of pressure-based game that really cuts you off from your teammates. And then if they know, some, if they choose to put them together, then obviously the depth is an issue up and down the roster. So, you know, for what it just seems to me like whatever Boston does, it's sort of a situation where you gotta rob Peter to pay Paul, and it's a very difficult it's a very difficult situation to try and make things add up, right, in terms of depth.
Yeah, let's save the Pasternak thing for a second because I've got a whole bunch of notes on that. I just want to stick with sort of Florida's offense versus Boston's defense here for a second because I just thought McAvoy was very susceptible to mistakes and had a really rough round one. And I think how they go after him is going to be very visible right away. Funny enough, I actually thought his partner, Mason Lorai, you know, he's so relatively inexperienced and unproven at this level. I love his mentality, though. Like, you can tell he's just completely unleashed there, just trying to constantly make plays happen. At the same time, though, I had someone in the league message me and be like, I love his game as well, but he really needs to learn how to protect himself better. Like, he's so awkward in his movements sometimes there. And against this Panthers forecheck, I'm very curious to see how that goes for him. So I think that's like a kind of area of strength versus weakness for me. And the other is how Florida is going to be able to get into the inside of the offensive zone, right? Because Swayman is clearly playing at a remarkably high level right now. He gave up just 9 goals in 6 games, had a 950 save percentage against Toronto. He didn't really give up a single bad goal, I thought, the entire way. Yet Toronto, despite the fact that a lot of expected goals models have them grading out pretty well in that matchup, I thought a lot of their offensive approach was pretty weak. It was a lot to the outside. You look even in Game 7, for example, their leading shot attempt player was Joel Edmondson. And I think that was very reflective of what they were able to create and what Boston was willing to give up to them. And so in this series, we know that Florida can sometimes get into that Carolina approach of just shooting from everywhere and then trying to get rebounds and puck hunt. But I also feel like facilitating through Tkachuk down low and stuff, they just have way better, I guess, options or outlets for carving up that defensive zone structure and getting to the inner slot.
Yeah, and I just think like this series, it's going to be a counterattack series just because, you know, during the Toronto versus Boston series, Boston was happy to let Toronto, you know, gain the blue line and keep the outside and maybe bleed some shot attempts. But, you know, Swayman's one of the best in the league at making saves sort of from shots outside the dots or these perimeter shots. And Boston plays a fairly passive 1-2-2 neutral zone when the other team is setting up on the breakout. But, you know, the way to really hurt Boston is if they play with the puck and then they turn it over, like that's where Florida can really assert itself because they have that speed off the rush with like the Verhaeghes and, you know, the Barkovs and the Reinhardts and the Tkachuks of the world. But then for Boston, the way for them to survive is to have the puck a lot. It is to try to make plays with it. So that's going to be interesting because if Boston doesn't manage the puck, but also be dangerous with it, then Florida can run away with the game.
Yeah. I mean, Swayman played so well. He just gets around everything. His positioning is so solid, but you're right. Like a lot of it from the outside and from these kind of perimeter outside angles, he's able to square that up. Florida, I think, just creating havoc in front of him and getting more side-to-side movement is going to be key here. Otherwise, we could see some games where their efficiency kind of dries up and all of a sudden Swayman's having just massive save percentage games, but I feel like they have other options to kind of carve through that. Let's talk about Pasternak and the Bruins offense. Then he got called out by Jim Montgomery, as you said, after Game 6. He responded in Game 7 with a signature overtime winner off of a cool set play that has sort of been a bread and butter for the Bruins for years now in their utilization of it. And, you know, even before that goal, though, I thought that it was just such a better performance that was more in line with what we've come to expect from him, right? He started dancing with the puck. He had this play where he kind of like shook David Camp and took the puck to the net. He had that rush attempt against Labushkin, I believe, where he went through the legs and created that way. And throughout that series, I think there was a lot of dialogue about whether he was hurt or what was happening and why he was producing so poorly. I don't believe he's hurt, or at least to a point where it's a big difference maker, because it would be kind of crazy, in my opinion, if his coach called him out if he was actually playing significantly less than 100%. I thought that the Leafs just did a really good job of preparing and game planning for him. Like, you even look, I noted that play where it's sort of one of his core plays offensively, where he loops around behind the net, comes into the slot, and then gets a look that way and shakes open. the Leafs were just sitting on that all series, right? You even saw in that game seven where Edmondson kind of caught him with a big hit and laid him out on that exact play. And so he'll have to find unique ways to shake open and get free in the offensive zone. And that's going to be easier said than done against this Panthers team after what we just saw guys like Gus Forsling against Sasha Barkov do to Nikita Kucherov in round one.
Yeah, and the thing with Pasternak is, in a lot of ways, his game is similar to Kucherov's, but I just find Kucherov is a better, more dynamic puck carrier. Like, you'll see Kucherov take the puck from D-zone to O-zone with more consistency, and he's a little bit more comfortable having the puck on his stick, whereas Pasternak, you know, you can see flashes where maybe he gets a step on a guy and he catches the puck in stride, but mostly Pasternak is at his most dangerous when he's off the puck, right? When let's say like a Palazaka is able to protect the puck and you know, create an extra moment and then find Pasternak for a shot off the catch or one timer or something like that. And again, like it's almost like the fact that he's not producing says more about his line mates or the line composition than his actual level.
But that actually might serve him well potentially, I think, in this series in terms of being more off the puck, right? Because in round one, here's the stats for you. In the three home games the Panthers had where Paul Maurice had the benefit of last change, Gus Forsling was out there for 33 of Nikita Kucherov's 45 minutes, and he was just on him every step of the way. He was meeting him at Tampa Bay's defensive zone blue line. He was picking him up, contesting, knocking pucks away, not really allowing him to sort of establish any clean puck touches early on in these breakout sequences to kind of establish rhythm and get going. And you could sort of see that every step of the way. In hearing you talk about how Pasternak's kind of different, I feel like if guys like Zacha and even Geeky are able to hold their own as puck carriers and kind of transport it a little bit, maybe it's possible that Pasternak can sort of free himself up and get a little bit more open, because it'll just be tougher for a guy like Forsling to check him because he just won't be on the puck as often.
So that could definitely be the case. The other thing that I see as a bit of a positive for Pasternak is that he's a right-hander who likes to play in the left wing, and Kucherov is a left-hander who likes to play in the right wing. So what that means is that Pasternak is mostly going to be matched up against Aaron Ekblad, Brendan Montour, and whoever the Panthers dress as their third right D. And that's obviously a less, at least in terms of gap control and things like that, it's a less difficult assignment than having to go up against Forsling. Obviously, you know, Ekblad can cross-check you like there's no tomorrow. Montour is a little bit more exploitable, so perhaps that's a matchup that Boston's looking at.
I like that. My one final note on this is, with the Bennett injury, and it sounds like he'll be out to start the series and potentially come back at some point, we initially saw them sort of replace him with Lundell, just one-for-one swap in that second-line scoring role. In Game 5, Paul Maurice sort of mixed it up to close out that series and went with a nuclear option of playing Barkov, Verhaeghe, and Tkachuk together. And in doing so, he used Lundell, Lustarinen, and Reinhardt, who had so much success as a sort of defensive checking line last postseason during their run to the Cup final, and they used those guys in a shutdown role along with Forsling against Kucherov, and that freed up Barkov and Tkachuk and Verhaeghe to just cook offensively. They created three goals in that game, and so I don't necessarily think we're going to see Florida use that trio together for a full series, because it seems like a bit kind of overkill and diminishes their depth across the lineup, especially in a series where I feel like they like their depth more than Boston's. But at the same time, just seeing that in their back pocket is interesting, and I wonder if we do see that again for as long as Bennett's out.
Well, I mean, if Boston goes with Pasternak, Zacha, and Marchand on the same line, then that for me is a natural counter from Florida.
It is. I don't know what we probably won't see that. They've been splitting those guys up even on the power play. Like, we saw Jim Montgomery put them together in some key spots with the man advantage, but I don't really know what Boston's doing right now with splitting up their PP1 and PP2. I don't like when teams do that. It kind of shows that you're very uncomfortable with what you got going. And so, yeah, in this series with Florida's penalty kill being as good as it is, I'm not sure how many easy goals Boston's going to be able to create there. So I feel like, I don't know, are we in agreement here that as long as Florida sort of stays in control and plays their game, the only way they can really use is if they sort of shoot themselves in the foot? And by that, I also mean, like, you look at round one, And in a series that we figured, all right, Battle of Florida, you know, they're going to try to get under each other's skin. Matthew Tkachuk comes away from those five games with zero penalties and was really disciplined and in control of himself the entire time. It feels like if they're able to maintain that, they just have so many more problems they can create, but also answers to Boston's problems than vice versa.
Well, the two wild cards obviously is goaltending first. I mean, if Swayman plays, you know, 950 this in the series, and Bobrovsky plays like 880 and then gets pulled, maybe the outcome is different. But also, you know, you mentioned Boston's power play, and I've actually really liked Geeky and Coyle and Zaka and Marchand, kind of like those guys working down low. And Florida's, if I recall correctly, Florida plays a very similar PK to Toronto, where it's more of a diamond, and the diamond is more susceptible to getting overrun down low near the net. So perhaps if Boston gets a few goals in the power play like they did against Toronto, maybe the series can be a little bit closer than expected.
I like that. Is there any other notes you have on the series, or do you want to move on to Rangers Hurricanes?
No, let's move on. We got a lot to talk.
We got a lot to talk about. Okay, so we're doing this game or this series, obviously, with the benefit of seeing game one. You and I were kicking around the idea of doing this on Sunday morning, potentially before that series started, but it just didn't make sense logistically. So we're going to cheat a little bit. We have seen game one. Obviously, don't want to overreact to any one game sample, and we've seen that series can instantly change after that. But I did think there was some interesting stuff in there with how the Rangers' offense uniquely gave Carolina's potent defense problems. What do you see from that in that game one, or that either confirmed what you were expecting heading in or potentially went against it, and kind of how do we feel about this series tactically?
Well, the one thing that on my Twitter feed I made a point of talking about is the Rangers power play versus Carolina's PK. And you know, those units are the best, among the best in the league at their respective disciplines. And like the Rangers top unit was just fantastic. Like they scored two goals off of sort of tic-tac-toe plays where the players knew exactly who was where, what they wanted to do, and what Carolina was going to do in response. And they were able to move the puck much quicker than Carolina can organize its pressure and get it behind the goalie. So, I mean, obviously it's a cause for optimism for Rangers fans. I wouldn't necessarily expect it to be this easy the rest of the series because, again, like Carolina's PK is among the best in the league, but that's going to be a big topic. And also at 5-on-5, the shots were pretty even, which, you know, if you're Carolina and the shots are even, that means they're not playing all that well. But in terms of zone time, I think Carolina still had a big edge. So I think if they just clean up some aspects of their ozone play and maybe, you know, get some better looks, like this series is far from over.
Oh, certainly. And yeah, you're right. The zone time was about as skewed as you're going to see over the course of a game, but obviously the Rangers won. Yeah, on the power play note, I think people might be surprised that weren't following closely to know that during the regular season, the Hurricanes actually finished 0.01 goals per 60 better than the Rangers with the man advantage. But man, just watching that Rangers power play, it's such a nightmare to corral. And I think, you know, in game one, they scored the two power play goals in just 23 seconds of time. They've now scored 8 power play goals in under 25 minutes this postseason, which rivals Edmonton's freak show, essentially. The challenge, I think, that they pose for a penalty kill that's as aggressive as the Hurricanes are in terms of pressuring, you could sort of see on that first power play goal, I believe, right, where each kind of failed pressure attempt that Hurricanes put up and apply snowballs. And so what that means is, like, if you go back and watch that one, right off the draw, Jordan Staal chases Fox at a point. Fox gets it over to Panarin on the wall. Orlov sprints at him and doesn't get the puck, and Panarin makes this nifty little backhand pass around him. And then all of a sudden, they've split up the PK, and it's a 3-on-2 below the dots. And then it takes a brilliant pass from Kreider, and maybe you don't expect that every single time, but it just creates this like alley-oop dunk for Zibanejad. And what stands out is I don't think this Rangers team, part of it is they've played together for so long, that unit, right? It's what, going 4 or 5 years now with Trocheck coming in for Strom being really the only change amongst that personnel group. But the chemistry they have, how they move around and kind of dissect you and get the puck into dangerous areas, but also they don't get flustered, right? Like, you see how many plays they're making on the backhand, how they're funneling the puck exactly where they want to go. It's so precise and methodical. And against this Canes penalty kill, which is a big strength of theirs, I do think it can kind of be a challenging thing for them and give the Rangers potentially a leg up in the series.
Yeah, and I think the area that I would look at if I were the Hurricanes is, what do I need to do to win the first faceoff? Because as good as this Rangers top unit is in terms of handedness, in terms of player attributes and style, when you win the first faceoff, you get the clear and you force them to re-enter the zone. That's where they can lose a lot of time. Because, like, for instance, Adam Fox, who's going to be the one dropping the puck, he's not really super comfortable entering the zone himself like a Makar could. So he's a little bit more one-dimensional. You know, Panarin is obviously one of the most dynamic puck carriers in the league, but, you know, he doesn't have the same sort of speed and explosiveness that McDavid has. So, again, if you can get that first clear and force him to come back and try to re-enter, especially for Carolina, who's very good at denying the line and pressuring immediately post entry, then you could, maybe you see this Rangers top unit get a little bit flustered or lose their confidence a little bit.
I agree with that in theory. The issue for the Hurricanes is that Vinny Trocheck right now is winning 73% of his offensive zone draws this postseason. Now, obviously a very small sample, but he was one of the best in the league at nearly like 60%, I believe, in the regular season. And generally on the show, we sort of scoff at or eye roll people placing such an emphasis on faceoffs. I do think you're seeing this postseason, though, this sort of trend of the value of winning offensive zone draws, particularly because it feels like teams are getting so good at optimizing the set plays they're running off of them to just manufacture looks, right? And it's almost gotten to the point, I think, where even if it doesn't necessarily lead to a goal, a set playoff, an offensive zone draw that immediately leads to a chance is nearly the equivalent of a rush chance, right? Because the opposing defense just isn't in a set position. And so all of a sudden you're quickly catching them off guard and getting a quick look. And so for the Rangers, that's what we're seeing there. And Trocheck in that way is a really big weapon for this group.
Yeah. And again, you know, I talked about the skill sets and the handedness on that first faceoff. Obviously, as a power play team, you get to pick the side. So the Rangers are going to pick the right dot every single time for Trocheck. And then off the win, it either goes to Panarin, who comes in to help, who's a righty. So he has a forehand pass to Zibanejad, or it goes to Fox, who's also a righty, has a forehand pass to Zibanejad for a one-timer. So again, like, I think the great equalizer is not losing that draw or winning it clean and getting it down ice. And then after that, I think Carolina has a much better chance of neutralizing.
What do you think about it, this extending to or translating to even strength for the Rangers, just from the perspective of the way the Hurricanes defend and how man-on-man heavy they are and how aggressive they are? I wonder if the Rangers, like, I believe no one had more high danger passes than them this season. They do such a good job of sort of absorbing whatever pressure you place on them and then just picking you apart with their passing. You even saw that in game one at even strength. I think it didn't lead to a lot of grade A chances or anything by any means, but you could sort of see how unique they are in the way, like, they almost drag you with them to the outer edges of the offensive zone. And then they work that diagonal passing action. And it feels like Carolina can sometimes get into a little bit of trouble by being baited into sort of chasing them, getting out of position, and then leaving seams exposed. And with the Rangers finishing talent, that's kind of scary, especially with, you know, watch Freddie Anderson in game one. And he's been really good since he came back from his health scare, but also now all of a sudden, like, fatigue shouldn't be an issue because he's just had a full week off, but also he's playing a bunch of games in a row now. He looked a bit iffy playing it. And so all of a sudden now, if he's just being peppered with not a high volume of shots, but very dangerous ones, I think that's where Carolina's defensive structure and kind of their relative strength in that regard can become a bit of an issue against this Rangers particular offense.
Yeah, I mean the thing with Carolina is, like, when you beat their man-on-man pressure, they end up looking really bad. But what you sort of tend to forget is that maybe, like, in the minutes leading up to it, you've gotten zero shots because, you know, their pressure was right there and you couldn't really do anything. So I would say in aggregate, I don't think Carolina's D zone is going to be that big of a problem against the Rangers. I think they should do a pretty good job. That Panarin goal from last game where they turned it over at the offensive blue line, I think that's going to be a much bigger question mark, because historically, maybe, you know, a past Hurricanes team would have just put that puck deep and dumped it in as to avoid that turnover. But now they got more skilled players who like to create off controlled entry. So this is an area where, you know, it's a shift that's happening, you know, for this team. And now the question is, like, it when the chips are down, and like, are they going to stick with that, or are they going to revert to playing way more safe and way more sort of dump and chase and shoot and retrieve?
I will say, I did just think in game one that, to my eye test, both Lindgren and Schneider on the Rangers blue line were just like so much more aggressive and involved offensively in the ozone than I've become accustomed to seeing. Like, they were just pinching down the wall. I think there were multiple times where I noticed Ryan Lindgren behind the Hurricanes net, like he's Cale Makar. Now, obviously, I don't think that's something that's going to be like a theme of this series. But if they are going to play that way offensively, I do think it's going to pose some challenges for Carolina, and I'll be kind of watching that moving forward. Let's look at it the other way then. Hurricanes offense versus the Rangers defense, and Igor Shesterkin in particular. You know, in our round one preview, we talked a lot about how since they brought in Jake Guentzel, but even before that, this Hurricanes team seemed to kind of acknowledge the limitations they had offensively previously, and were making a concerted effort of attacking more off the rush themselves, off of prioritizing those regroups and re-entries that we like to get second and third opportunities and catch teams off guard, as opposed to just sort of dumping it in and then getting into their set offense. This Rangers team, one of their relative weaknesses for much of the season has been defending against the rush, because they've been more aggressive themselves attacking. So it's left their defenders kind of more isolated and on an island. And we did see the one, this wasn't an example of that because they were actually set in their 1-3-1 structure as well as you could be. But the Hurricanes did get one of their goals that helped them claw back into it off of a play where Natchez essentially is coming down the middle and creates off the rush and scores and beats Shesterkin. So I don't know. Do you think that this Hurricanes team is better suited this go around to actually do so and follow through on that and kind of punish the Rangers off the rush, maybe more so than they were able to in the past?
Okay, so just a bit of clarification to what you're talking about in terms of the Rangers' neutral zone play. So like some other teams out there, for example, LA or Toronto, the Rangers have two different neutral zone forechecks. So one of them is the 1-3-1 trap, which you can see if you look up Nietzsche's goal from game one. Basically, you got, you know, all five players sitting in the neutral zone waiting for the Hurricanes to make something happen, okay? But then if the Rangers are playing with the puck in the offensive zone and there's a turnover or something like that, they'll defend in a 1-2-2 like many other NHL teams. So in terms of the systems aspect of it, the Rangers have a little bit more complexity, and the players are being asked to switch between being extremely passive versus sprinting as hard as they can to, you know, recover from the offensive zone. So that's a layer of complexity that, you know, it's not all that difficult for Carolina to adjust to, but it's something to keep in mind. So the thing with the Rangers is that in the neutral zone, they also play sort of a man on man like Carolina. So they're the best, I would say, man on man teams in the East, except the Rangers, like their forwards, they play a little bit looser. So they're more about blocking shots and taking advantage of bobble pucks than actually going stick on puck and being like right in your face like Carolina is, but it's still a man on man. So I think that the thing that Carolina can exploit, obviously, is if the Rangers mismanage a puck to turn it over, they have to get into this 1-2-2. You know, their Ds are, you know, they need some help, right? So that's an area of opportunity to create some sort of 3-on-2s, 2-on-1, so on and so forth. And then high in the Rangers zone, they can attack the Rangers D zone structure a little bit like how they would practice against their own. So that's a point of familiarity that can be interesting for Carolina as well.
Yeah, something the Rangers also struggled with this season was generally just breaking out of their zone with possession. Now, I do think that the late season change they made of splitting up Keandre Miller and Trouba and, you know, giving Trouba a partner like Gustafson and then giving Keandre Braden Schneider helps, because even if they're not necessarily completing these seamless passes up the ice to kickstart the transition, there's just fewer turnovers. And I think against this Hurricanes forecheck, I think that's going to be a big deal and something to watch as kind of like a leverage point. It was interesting in game one, we sort of saw the matchups, right? It was like Zibanejad versus Staal, Panarin versus the Nature's line, which is the range, what the Rangers like, I think, certainly against their relative defensive ability. And then we saw a lot of Wenberg's line with Cooley and Kako against Aho, and they did a really good job. And I was kind of joking in the Discord at the time watching the game, that line sort of feels like a very Carolina Hurricanes line, because they're just going to like lean on you in the offensive zone, and they're going to control territorially, and they're going to win the shot battle. Might not necessarily lead to goals, but I think that head-to-head, particularly for these games at MSG, I imagine Peter Laviolette and the Rangers will be very happy if they're able to just keep Aho's line with Guentzel defending in their own zone, as opposed to doing the opposite to them. And that's kind of what we saw in game one. And so I thought that was interesting, because the Hurricanes are just ultimately going to need Aho and Guentzel in particular, and their finishing ability, to create some goals against Shesterkin, because a lot of the other players on their team just don't have the finishing ability to do so.
Yeah, and it's interesting you brought that line, because obviously this season for the Rangers fan base, it was all about Lafreniere glow up playing with Panarin and finally sort of fulfilling a lot of the expectations. And like, at least on Twitter, like, it's been super quiet about Kako, right? Like, I haven't really heard anybody say anything positive about him. But if he can help that line at least sort of be somewhat above water against Aho and Guentzel, then like, that's what this team needs to really take the next step and be a legit cup contender, you know, to have that third line who can just absorb people and play them even.
Yeah, I mean, they played head-to-head 5:45 at 5-on-5 in game one, and shots were 3-0 for the Rangers in that time. So I think they'll take that every day of the week. And yeah, I think I'm really excited about this one. Like, game one was really high event and really fun, especially compared to some of the round one games we saw. And so I'm looking forward to seeing more of these two teams head to head, because they both pose kind of interesting challenges for each other. All right, Jack, let's take our break here. And then when we come back, we'll jump right back into it. We'll switch gears. We'll talk about the two West matchups, and we'll get into all that. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast, streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Miss any part of Halford and Brough in the Morning? Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, and don't miss an episode.
All right, we're back here in the Hockey PDOcast with Jack Conn. We're doing a round two preview. We did the two East matchups in part one. We're going to jump over to the West now. Let's start with Canucks Oilers. Obviously, a really fun matchup that's going to be really fun to watch on the ice, really fun to follow on Twitter as well. I think there's going to be a lot of back and forths. Do you want to start with the Oilers power play? Because it feels like when you're talking about that team, there's many different components that we're going to get into, but I just feel like any series involving them right now, the opposition is going to have to figure out, I think, a way to, beyond just saying, all right, we need to be disciplined and I'll take penalties, that's great, but sometimes you get called for penalties even if you don't really think you commit one. It's going to happen. If that happens and you get into these situations, is there anything you can realistically do that you see right now to make life more difficult for them, to at least pose some sort of challenge and provide a solution, I guess, that slows them up a little bit? You're not going to stop them, but just to make it so that they're not just scoring 9 goals in 27 minutes the way they did against LA and just completely lighting you up every time they get a chance.
Well, I mean, if I recently read a piece on The Athletic, I think it was about coaches weighing in on how to contain the Oilers power play. And I didn't really see a great answer in that article. And honestly, I don't really have one. If I did, I could probably charge a team like $250,000 to give him that secret sauce. But I just don't. I mean, the main thing is that when Draisaitl and McDavid end up on the same side of the ice, that's generally a recipe for disaster through the PK, because you can't possibly cover all the angles to the goal when they're lined up on the same side. But how do you prevent that? I don't know, because you're playing 4-on-5 and they can rotate however they want and they're going to get into that look. So I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, they're just eventually going to figure it out, right? I think LA, like at the start of that series, they were just getting absolutely roasted with backdoor passes, and Hyman was essentially just posting up there, or Nugent Hopkins at times, and they were just tapping in passes from Draisaitl and McDavid because of the attention those two guys were commanding. And so they made an interesting adjustment of like packing down really low and sort of prioritizing taking those guys away. The issue is, though, is that then McDavid's ability to just move more than anyone and cover as much ground as he does on the power play just solve for that immediately. And what they did is exactly what you mentioned there with the same side stuff, where they were just working all of these two-on-ones essentially on Dreisaitl's strong shooting side, and they were just doing give and goes and sort of eventually just putting the Kings PKs into a blender. And so I don't know what you do against that, right? When McDavid's just hunting the way he is with Dreisaitl's ability to one time from that dead zone angle in the zone, the backdoor plays. Another thing I was noting to you was just when watching this, just appreciate what they do to the opposing PK structure, because they compress the zone so much where Bouchard's essentially teeing off from like nearly inside the dots in the middle of the ice. Like, he's so low. And that's because of that respect these guys command down low, where you compare it to any other, you know, point man on another team's power play, and it's like at least a handful of feet closer to the net from the middle of the zone than anyone else establishes. It's just ridiculous what they do to you.
Yeah, I mean, like the closest thing I have to a solution is maybe you just let them have the Bouchard shot, because everything else is going to be more dangerous, right? Like, maybe if Bouchard misses the net, it goes out of the zone, or you can get a block on it, or whatever. I don't know. Like, that's probably the only thing I got.
Yeah, it probably is. I mean, relatively speaking, even though it's very dangerous, and also it's like, all right, this guy's just going to tee up this absolute cannon from really close range, which is frightening. It's probably, you're right, better than a Hyman tap-in backdoor or Dreisaitl getting his clean one-timer off. So you're right. I mean, this Canucks power penalty kill was huge against Nashville. They gave up only 2 goals against in 37 minutes. I wouldn't say it was a strength of theirs in the regular season, though. I think they were like 18th or 19th for the year. And this is just an entirely different challenge. So I think, like, comparing how they played in that series to what is going to look like is just not really equivalent in any way. What else interests you in this series beyond that? Because I think everyone, all right, we got the power play out of the way, everyone gets it. Is what else tactically or matchup wise do you think is something to really watch and key in on in this matchup?
So the matchup that I would focus on is Edmonton's offensive zone cycle versus Vancouver's D-zone coverage. If you go on Twitter and you follow some of the smart Oilers fans, they'll tell you that the Oilers are actually more of a ozone possession and cycle team than a rush team. Obviously, they've got some of the best rush players in the world, but a lot of their offensive volume comes from getting the puck into the zone and then working around and then creating shots that way. And the thing is that Vancouver is very much comfortable sort of keeping the play to the outside in their zone and blocking some shots and playing a sort of a zone defense that lulls you to sleep, basically. So for Edmonton, it's about managing the puck, not getting sort of low quality point shot blocked or turnovers the other way. Maybe getting their weak side defenseman involved, maybe using some two, three sort of IO zone cycles. Basically just finding the gaps between Vancouver's players and attacking downhill. Because if they just go low to high point shot into shin pads, that's going to fuel the Canucks counterattack, and that's not going to be a good result for them.
And that was a theme in round one, right? Everyone was talking about how the shot totals were so low in that Nashville-Vancouver series, but that was entirely by design. And all year, Rick Tocchet's had them playing such a disciplined game in their own zone in that sense. What Edmonton does is, off of those cycles, they get you into trouble and create space for themselves in open looks with a lot of these kind of like interchanges up high, right? Where they force a switch and a miscommunication, and then all of a sudden they've got extra space to work with. And I do think the Canucks can handle that better than most teams can in this case, because they're just less aggressive, as you noted, right? Like, they're not really going to pursue you that often up high and kind of get themselves into trouble by chasing, because they're actually looking to stay compact and disciplined and kind of protect that slot the way they did in round one. And so it's easier said than done, especially with the weapons and firepower Edmonton has. If they're just keeping the puck in the offensive zone, eventually they're going to find a crack and break through, right? But at the same time, assuming they stick to their script, Vancouver probably is positioned to hold up as well as I think you could hope for in this type of matchup. So that is interesting. What about the actual sort of head-to-heads? How would you go about that here? Because I think initially you'd say, all right, well, let's use Elias Lindholm against McDavid. Well, the issue is, the last time we saw that head-to-head in the 2022 postseason, McDavid put 7 5-on-5 goals on him in 34 minutes and eviscerated him about as badly one-on-one as you're going to see in that type of setting, then you go, okay, well, let's use JT Miller's line. Well, the issue is that if it holds true to form in round one, that line was really the only line that was able to create any sort of consistent offense for Vancouver. And so I don't think you necessarily want them just using all their energy chasing McDavid around the ice. And so then it gets to Pettersson, and that's a whole nother can of worms because he notably really struggled in round one. And I don't think it's, I mean, I guess it could conceivably get him going to just kind of focus on defense. But at the same time, for a player that's struggling, I wouldn't say throwing him to the Wolves in a McDavid head-to-head is necessarily the best way to go about sparking him.
Yeah, but I mean, like, every team is going to have a hard time matching up against McDavid and then Draisaitl, right? Because if, like, I think JT Miller's play style or, like, his mental makeup lends itself well to be a matchup center in these situations because, like, he's really competitive and, you know, he's got sort of, you know, an underrated mean streak. And I think he's going to enjoy the challenge a little bit like how, you know, Nazem Kadri, when he was with the Leafs, was kind of like the team's top shutdown center, sort of for the same reason. But then, okay, well, are you putting Elias Lindholm against Leon Draisaitl or Elias Pettersson against Leon Draisaitl? Like, that's still not a great matchup for the Canucks, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's kind of like pick your poison.
It certainly is. I'd say I actually am intrigued more so by going Miller versus Draisaitl from the Canucks' perspective, because I just feel like Leon is sort of the ultimate barometer for this Oilers team, right? Like, he played so well in round one, was just so engaged and involved on every shift. And when he's playing that way, it just encourages Edmonton to stick to using their lines the way they have. And I think that makes them a much more difficult team to match up with in the long haul, and then gets you into those pick your poison situations. Whereas if they struggle out of the gate, or Vancouver does a good job neutralizing that line a little bit, maybe Chris Knobloch all of a sudden goes back to playing Draisaitl with McDavid more often than not. And then I think for Vancouver's perspective, it's easier to kind of load up defensively a little bit, and you sort of, you're already beating them in terms of that tactical battle. So I'm curious to see what they do. I think an interesting thing to watch for here is always with this Oilers team, it's the CeCe Nurse pairing, right? In round one, they played 82 minutes. They got outshot 54-37. They got outscored 4-2 by LA. They make mistakes, and those mistakes usually wind up in the back of their net. They really, in particular, struggle with kind of like speedy wingers, I think. We saw guys like Victor Arvidsson and Blake Lizotte really give them trouble in round one. And that's why I think someone like Connor Garland is such a focus in this series for me, because if he's him, Joshua, and if it's Lindholm as their center, are able to create off the forecheck and then cycle the puck and do what they've done all season, I think they can have success against a defensive pair like that. And so for Vancouver generating offense against this Oilers team, they struggled beyond JT Miller's line to really do so in round one. But I do think in this matchup, they could probably have some success if they go that way.
Yeah, and this is especially true if Vancouver is on the counterattack, and, you know, the Oilers just turned the puck over in the O-zone and CeCe and Nurse are backpedaling. Like, this is where they're the most vulnerable, because if the play is in front of them and they're skating down, let's say, to pinch on a puck, they can use their bodies and they can do some damage, and they're pretty comfortable because the job is very straightforward. But as soon as there's a speed and a decision-making aspect that comes into play, that's really where Nurse and CeCe struggle. And that's why I think, you know, their actual sort of outputs have always been a little bit less impressive than, you know, the physical tools that they bring to the table, is because as soon as there's a speed and a decision-making aspect to the play, then they're just a little bit slow reacting.
Yeah, let's put your coaching hat on here. What do you do to get Pettersson going in this series? Because he really struggled against Colton Seasons in round one. 112 minutes overall, 0 goals, 3 assists, just 8 shots on goal, got outscored 3-1 in that head-to-head. And I feel for him, because, like, right now you look at who he's playing with for the most part, and Ilya Mikheyev almost seems to be operating under the idea that if you shoot the puck directly into the goalie's chest, you actually get credit for a goal, because that's the only explanation for every single one of his shot attempts. And so I don't think he's certainly being put in a position to succeed. I don't think it's a coincidence that the series clinching goal comes with him making a play on the wall while he's out there with Besser and Suter, and it leading to a goal off a nice pass by Besser and a finish by Suter. So potentially it's play him with better players. I'm not sure if we're going to see that because the Canucks seem to be set in this current kind of lineup formation. If you're the coach, what are you doing to get him going? Because I think you just need the best version of Elias Pettersson if you're going to compete in this type of series.
So when I think of Elias Pettersson, I kind of think of like Mitch Marner West, because these are two players who are extremely productive, who do a lot of great things, who are easy to shut down in the postseason. And it's like, I find that their problems are pretty similar in that they both like to carry the puck in front of them. So they're always exposing the puck, which a lot of times isn't a problem because they have such quick hands and they're able to anticipate and make plays, you know, from that posture. But when they don't have time or space to operate, and when physicality is a bigger part of the game, that's when they start kind of struggling and forcing plays, because they're not able to shield the puck and to take contact or initiate contact. So again, like, I see a parallel between these two, and it's not really, unfortunately, like it's nothing that you can do within a week to really fix the situation, or to you can certainly put them with players that sort of alleviate these issues. But again, this is just something fundamental to their game that lends itself less well to the postseason when time and space is at a premium and you're generally playing against better organized defensive structures. Now, just going back to what we talked about previously with matching against Edmonton. Well, perhaps what Vancouver could do is deploy the Miller line as much as possible in the O-zone, because, you know, they were the line that was the most productive in the first round. Maybe play Lindholm and start that line in the D-zone more often, because so Lindholm is a right-handed center, and if he's taking faceoffs, he's potentially at an advantage against whether Draisaitl or McDavid, who are lefties. Maybe, you know, he can kind of work the right-handed advantage on the right dot. And then for Pettersson, start him on the fly as much as possible so that he doesn't get bogged down with having to play in either zone. And maybe, you know, because like starting a player on the fly more often is a way to shelter them and to get them into a type of game that's got more flow to it, that's more speed based as opposed to kind of a half ice kind of game. And maybe doing that is going to allow Pettersson to get some looks off the rush where he's got time and space to get a shot off or to make a play.
Hmm. I do think if this series goes on and the struggles continue, I'd be very intrigued in seeing them potentially give him some looks with Garland and Joshua, who have been so good as a pair this year, and just create some opportunities where he's actually able to, in space, create some plays, because those guys do such a good job in other areas. But I don't know, I'm going to push back a little bit on that, just because one, and we haven't necessarily seen it in that round one series against the Preds where he did struggle, but I think Pettersson this year in particular has just gotten so much stronger that when he's at his best and when he's at feeling himself and humming, he actually does initiate contact, and I think can create space for himself that way and is comfortable playing in those areas. And so that's kind of what's strange about the struggles we saw there. And the other is, I just don't think it's really fair necessarily. I get what you're saying from like a stylistic perspective and kind of the tendencies with the puck, but like, we've only seen Pettersson in a postseason setting once before. It was in that weird bubble situation, but I thought he excelled and was really good in it. Whereas this is like years and years of a recurring theme for someone like Marner. So I just want to point that out, because I'm sure there was listeners here that were like freaking out because you compared the two, and I get what you're saying, but there are interesting discrepancies between them. Any other notes on this series? Do you think that this series will lend itself from a game environment perspective to being higher scoring? Because that Canucks Predators one was obviously so low scoring. These are two teams that were first and third in expected goals against out of the 16 playoff teams in round one. I think the Canucks would certainly prefer for it to be lower scoring, but people seem to be under the impression that because of, I guess, the Oilers' reputation, we're going to see a matchup here where there are more goals scored on the board. I'm just not sure that's the case if the Canucks get their way. And I think the Oilers themselves might be comfortable with that as well, because we saw down the stretch of that Kings series, they were willing to sort of, whether it was playing down to their opponent or just kind of being comfortable playing their preferred style, they sort of grinded out those games and kind of chose to prove that they can win these ugly playoff contests. And they weren't necessarily the types of games we sort of equate to Oilers hockey.
Well, I think certainly the Canucks would like every game in this series to have like 15 to 15 sort of shot counts. I think Edmonton's odds of winning go up as soon as the pace of play starts to increase. Whereas for Vancouver, it's more about like absorbing the speed and getting into their structure and then hoping to strike a couple of times a game off counterattacks.
All right. Well, this is going to be a fun one. I'm looking forward to this as well. Pretty much every one of these series is going to be awesome. And as we save the best for last, in my opinion, I think the one people are most excited to see, Avalanche Stars. Let's get into that one. What's top of mind here? Because I've got about 70 different storylines that I think we can key on, but I'll give you the floor here to give me your favorite one.
Well, the thing that like in our round one preview, I said I liked the Jets because I thought their middle six was better than the Avs' middle six, and it turned out that the middle stat line had a heck of a series. So that really surprised me.
It did. I mean, they were awesome. Him and Lehkonen. I think that is an interesting point to start here, because in sizing these two teams up, I would say, you know, you look at the Stars' strengths and they don't really give up a lot off of counter plays and off of rush plays. They're really good at breaking the puck out against the forecheck, especially now with Harley playing such a big role for them. They create offensively high danger looks in the middle of the ice and down low. So theoretically, you look at all those things and say, well, relative to any weaknesses Colorado has, I feel pretty good about that. On paper, they match up really well. The issue is, as you noted, I felt that exact same way before round one. And I think as Winnipeg showed and as Colorado showed us, it's one thing to sort of say that on paper. It's another to actually go out there and do it against this Avalanche team that's playing as well as it did in that series. And in a way, like, I think what makes it so fun and exhilarating for us, but also so tough to size up as well in this preview, is I felt in round one, Vegas was a unique team, but also very predictable in so many ways. And I just find this Colorado team much more unpredictable. And I think that's what makes them dangerous for Dallas, where I think it's going to be so much more difficult to sort of prepare, because it's one thing to say, all right, well, yeah, they move really fast in the neutral zone. They're a nightmare off the rush. Their forecheck's good, but they've proven that at their best, they can just create in so many ways, and you can't just necessarily game plan for one thing.
Yeah, and the Jack Johnson Sean Walker situation was less problematic than we thought. I mean, if they can go three pairings deep, then they're going to be hard to really problem solve, I guess.
Well, here's one thing for you: the Stars are putting a ton of miles on their top four defensemen right now, right? They've essentially been using five defensemen functionally in all of that round one series, and I think after Nils Lundqvist's mistake in Game 7 defending the rush, I think it'll be even more so in this series. So you get to this point where Miro played 192 minutes, Harley, Tanev, and Lindell all played north of 160. And the Avalanche, by comparison, Makar led them with 124. Devontaze was a 118. And then no other defender played over 100. And that doesn't even mention the discrepancy between the two teams of Dallas just played this grueling 7-game series that just ended, and they're jumping back into this series 2 days later, whereas Colorado's been resting for about a week. So I guess you can make the argument that, like, all right, they're coming in with a little momentum and they're in rhythm. But at the same time, I just think with how much they're putting on the plate of these defenders, they've held up remarkably well so far. But heading into a series against Colorado that's going to, you know, ratchet the pace up to 11 and pressure you every single time, that's kind of a dangerous game for me in terms of how much you're asking some of these top four guys to shoulder.
Yeah, I don't know how well they're going to hold up necessarily, but I mean, when you think of all-time great defensemen like, you know, Nick Lidstrom and Zdeno Chara, like, those guys played half the game during the postseason, and they went, you know, their teams went deep consistently. So maybe when you have a freak of nature like, you know, Heiskanen and maybe even Harley's on his way to getting there, but maybe you can play them half the game and it'll be fine. I don't know.
But aren't the responsibilities just night and day? Like, in terms of like how much ground these guys are covering and how involved and how much they're asked to do offensively as well. Like, you look in round one, and I thought Miro did everything we've ever hoped for him offensively in terms of like how aggressive and involved he was. And then he also wound up being on the ice for six of Vegas's 9 5-on-5 goals against as a result of it, because he wasn't really getting much support. Now, as that series went along, I think we saw Harley adjust to kind of being more of the guy who stays back and kills plays and provides that support for him. But that's going to be a tricky thing to sort of navigate and balance against a team like Colorado, where if you get caught deep, you're going to be fishing the puck out of the back of your net because they're that good off the rush.
Yeah, it's hard to say until the game starts, and I hope to see.
Well, that's what we're doing here, Jack. Right? We got a preview. We got to try to give the listeners a take on what we think is going to happen. We can't just be like, all right, well, let's just see how this goes. We got to give them a little something here. Okay, how about this? Dallas, I don't think for all of the strengths offensively and all the weapons they have, doesn't really grade out as a very good passing team. And this Colorado team has shown that with that forecheck and with their ability to turn 50-50 pucks and turnovers into grade A rush chances, I think that could be kind of a thing to watch here in terms of how Dallas manages the puck and how they try to play with the threat of what we just saw Colorado do to Winnipeg, and whether that affects their own aggression or if they try to compensate for it. I think that's going to be an interesting thing to watch.
Yeah, and the thing that works a little bit in Dallas's favor is that even though on defense they're very top heavy, like up front they're really deep.
Yeah.
Right. And they got potentially Mason Marchman coming back, whose style I think would be a great addition to this series, because he pretty much plays all out all the time, and he can create a lot of problems physically for Colorado's defensemen. And also, if they need to inject some more youth into their roster, there's the Maverick Bork, who's been yo-yoing up and down and not really getting to games, but like he's right there. I think he was league MVP in the AHL, so he's ready to move on to the show. So I think if Dallas is looking to really lessen the load on the defensemen, they're not adverse to flipping the puck out of the zone and letting the forwards do most of the work. So perhaps that works out.
Yeah, that'll be an interesting thing to watch. I think another I'd say is the goaltending here, because on the one hand, we saw what Colorado did to Hellebuck, right? Where they scored 10 goals off of screen plays. I think Hellebuck had like a 737 save percentage according to Mike Kelly on these screenshots. And Vegas, on their limited power play opportunities, showed that they had a bit of success with kind of working those high tips and getting traffic in front of Ottinger. And so how Dallas reacts to that will be interesting. And then the other end, Vegas was so aggressive with that sort of defensive zone fronting and trying to take away Dallas's own tips, and essentially just took a guy like Joe Pavelski out of the series doing so. In this matchup, I actually do think Dallas might have a bit of success with that, because Colorado this year was susceptible to losing some of those battles around the net. I think that's why we were so high on Winnipeg heading into that series, right? Now, that played out in game one. Games 2-5, Winnipeg just never had the puck and never really got to maintain enough offensive zone time to even put that to the test. And that's a credit to the way Colorado played. But if Dallas is able to, I think, establish a bit more offensive zone time, that would be an area that I think they can give Georgiev some trouble and bring back that kind of storyline and sort of get into their heads and create a bit more offensively than Winnipeg was ever really able to do.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know a ton about goalies necessarily. I just think that I'd rather go into a series with Jake Ottinger as my goalie instead of Alexander Georgiev, because I've never really trusted Georgiev. And obviously, after a pretty rough game one, he's really recovered and he played well the rest of the way. But I don't know. I still don't trust it.
Yeah. I think this Avalanche offense is so terrifying. They got goals from 12 different players in round one. And, before the third period of that last closeout game, MacKinnon and Rantanen had only combined for two themselves, yet they finished the series with 24 non-empty net goals in five games. And as you mentioned off the top, what they got from Mittelstadt and Lehkonen, along with me fully expecting that Makar and MacKinnon will fully get going in this series as well, it's going to be really difficult. I think regardless of how well Jake Ottinger is playing and how well Dallas played defensively against Vegas, this is probably going to be, to my question about Edmonton, Vancouver, I do think this is a series that's going to feature a lot more scoring. And I think that's going to be really fun for us to watch, but also going to be fascinating to see how it plays out. Any other notes on either of these two teams? I've got some stuff on like Wyatt Johnson and Stankoven, but I've also spoken about them so much throughout this postseason that it's not necessarily anything new.
They're good.
they are very good. I do think like Stankoven's work kind of back checking and disrupting up the middle of the ice could pay dividends against this Colorado team and create some problems for them in terms of transporting the puck. And I do think it's interesting that they also, in the most important game of their season, they played him like in two stretches. We saw him with Hintz Robertson, but they went fully to it in game seven. And that shows not only how well he's playing, how much they trust him, but also just how important he is. And I think getting guys like Hintz and Duchesne going, they're probably also better suited for a series like this in terms of scoring, potentially with a bit more space. And so, yeah, there's just a lot of moving parts of this. It's going to be really fun to watch. Are you leaning either way on this one? We obviously don't really prioritize doing picks on this type of show because I think it's like the most boring part of previews. But do you have either a lean on how you feel about these two teams heading into the series?
Okay, so the only playoff pull I'm doing is with the staff of a restaurant that I go to often near my place. And I had Dallas and Carolina making the cup finals. So that's what I have.
All right. Well, we'll see. It'll be interesting. I mean, three out of the four games they play in this regular season, and they were so evenly dispersed throughout, were absolute barn burners with a ton of goals and back and forth. And I think we're going to see a lot of that series. So, all right. I think that's all I've got on this one. Looking forward to seeing it all play out. Jack, plug some stuff here on the way out. Let the listeners know either what you got cooking up or sell them on the hockey tactics.
So my girlfriend just went back to work after mat leave. So I'm not available to watch hockey with you, unfortunately, but if you like to get my two cents on what I'm seeing, follow me on Twitter. It's JHANHKY. And then if you want sort of my knowledge on NHL tactics distilled into an ebook, it's the Hockey Tactics 2024 ebook. You can get that through my Twitter page or on Gumroad.
Are you still doing the playoff promo code for the PDO guest listeners?
Yes. So if you at checkout, type in playoffs and that'll get you $10 off.
Awesome. Well, if you're listening to this and you want to get into it, definitely do so. It'll help a lot in enjoying this postseason and kind of getting your head around all the tactics, a lot of the stuff we broke down here, just in much greater detail. Jack, this is a blast. We'll have you on again soon, certainly if not before then, for the conference final previews as we jump back into this stuff, because I do feel like these sort of tactical previews are where we're at our best together. Keep up the great work, man. We'll have you on again soon. Thank you to listeners for listening to us, and enjoy the start of round two, and we'll be back soon here with plenty more of the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.